Well, hi, everybody. Sorry I'm running a minute late. I had a little trouble getting into my own conference line. Well, I hope everybody's doing great. I'm eager to hear if there are any questions or things you'd like to highlight or ask to be sure we incorporate into our final seminar at this time. Anything that you want to add, ask, highlight, or be sure that we talk about that you want to add to the hopper right now? Anyone? I hope I've answered the questions that each of you sent in, and I appreciate that as a guide to some things that might be really helpful. Specifically, I know we haven't talked about application to clients with ADHD for Ann's question, or actually the application to coaching inmates that Gina asked. But what we've been talking about is a kind of foundation that really addresses aspect, mind, and brain mastery, and the application in coaching is actually what we do in our coaching conversations and provide the framework of understanding of co-creating and developing the client story, whatever that is and whatever it is that the client focuses on. Now, one thing to remember, we've talked, and those of you who have worked with me other than in this seminar series, I use the metaphor of creating a coaching story for each session, and overall the coaching engagement becomes its own story, and we focus on certain aspects of a life story or wellness story or money story for a client. That's just a metaphor to help us understand. For example, in the coaching set for one coaching session, we typically ask someone what they want to focus on, where they want to get to at the end of the time, and then we co-create that and develop that story for that session with the client's point of reference. Every story has a beginning, middle, and end, a challenge, a development, and a resolution. And that's what creates a completeness. We're hardwired for stories. And that's what creates a way of making sense of and understanding something and creating a memory to make it more accessible. Now, remember, though, for each of your clients, they don't experience their story as a story. That's just the way things are. Story is our metaphor for understanding, and if it's applicable and helpful for us to understand, to really look at the elements and the development of that. In fact, if I can get this anywhere close, Margaret Atwood said it really clearly in her book, Alias Grace. She said something pretty close to, when you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but only a confusion. It's a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood. That's the experience that clients have at times. So our lives rarely follow a clear linear path. They're just experienced as a series of episodes. Remember when I mentioned that what we know now in terms of how the brain functions, it functions very analogous to a Google map. And you boot up a map, a scenario to deal with something. We have to have the story to make it sense, to make it make sense and to fit into our lives. So maybe only in retrospect these episodes have a beginning, middle, and end. And maybe only in retrospect it seems like a story rather than just day-to-day and what we do. So those are just reminders that while we're talking in the way we're talking, we're doing it in terms of seminar and training and not actually ways of talking to clients. If we want to have more of an application of that, I'll reserve some time at the end for that. But let me ask one more time, any questions or input or things you want to highlight to be sure that we cover in this final seminar? Well, I'll reserve some time at the end for us to have more of a discussion if you're interested in doing that. And we can talk about maybe the application of what we've been talking about, and if any of you want to do a vignette or a case illustration, we can do that. But I'm going to put us on lecture mode now and look at some aspects of operating systems and writing new stories. So hold on. Okay, that's why I had trouble getting access. I am not able to access the line where I can do lecture mode and discussion mode. We are constantly on discussion mode, so I'm going to ask you, if you would, to be sure and manage the background noise. Star 6 is mute. If each of you would go on mute now, and this is a do-it-yourself seminar, to go on mute, and then as you're ready to add or ask or have any discussion toward the end, to come off mute, star 6. So thank you for managing that. So first, as we talk about upgrading your operating system, remember we talked about 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious, goes on autopilot. So coming to understand how we're creating our experiences, that whatever we think and feel and experience, we create each moment. So we are creating our own story, but only perhaps in retrospect does it seem like a story as we're experiencing it. As I said, it's just the way things are. So let's look at some ways that we can look and understand how the brain and the mind combined organize material that can be useful to us in coaching. One of these, and this comes from various fields, from psychoanalysis, where as a clinician and contributing to the literature there, I looked at the sense of self, and that was a regular occurrence. There are many other disciplines. So let's look at a practical way, and what difference does this make in coaching? So brain imaging studies have demonstrated where the sense of self is in the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex. This part of the brain lights up when people self-reflect, when they make assessments in judgments regarding themselves. This is where and how neuroeconomists can predict when they show someone 10 items and ask which are they most likely to purchase. They can predict with over 95% accuracy what they will pick by looking at, when they look at each item in sequence, when their brain fires in this specific area with sense of self, that's the item they're going to pick, because that resonates with our identity. And that's so much a sense of purpose and looking at things in different ways, especially new and different things. Remember when we began this series, I posed the vampire problem and asked you, what is to this point the most different thing, the most unprecedented thing you've ever done? And to think about that and to look at what kind of experiences that you have had that might inform at least a way of approaching and thinking about and looking at the decisions that will need to be made. What's the one thing you did with no experience whatsoever? Some fairly common things. Parenthood. Now, you knew a lot of stuff about, you've seen it all and been around, but you hadn't been a parent, if you're a parent, being the caregiver of a parent with dementia, divorce, chemotherapy, menopause, many things you have and will deal with, your clients will deal with, without having a set of experiences to call on, to inform how to go about it. And a key element here is that when you have a categorically new and different experience, something that's unprecedented, that you have no model of how to deal with it, no experience in how to deal with it. So what that does is to render your intuition and your instinct at best useless, at worst misinformed, because intuition and instinct rely on mental representations and the processing of mental representations to simulate possibilities based on models already existing in the brain, instantaneously to move it to your prefrontal cortex to assign meaning and make it conscious and logical. When you don't have these experiences or any models to operate on, instinct will not be helpful, or if it uses old software, it can be misleading. So this is where we're looking in certain ways in coaching, to think about how can we help someone with when they have little or no experience in doing something. So one of the fundamental ways, and you, those of you who have who've looked at that blog that I recommended, by one of my favorite authors, I suggest that you go to my website and look under blogs. It's the current blog. It's called Vampire Problem. So what do you do when someone has, in coaching, when you're helping someone to understand and deal with something that they've never dealt with before? So the frameworks that you may consider can include the foundation of identity, of needs and ideals, because the reason we do things that we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. The reason that we're even considering doing what we're going to do is it fits our identity. Like observing those 10 things that you could purchase, the one that you light on is most likely one that fires that part of the brain that has to do with identity, with sense of self. So the first thing in working with a client, especially in a new or different area, is to regulate states of mind and create an understanding and a grounding in sense of self. And that is so fundamental, everything else follows. Being grounded and centered, regulated, means that you have access to all of the information in all of your states of mind, and puts you in a position to synthesize and integrate new things from that position, even to have access to experiences that may seem similar in the past, if that can be informative. So I probably saw, and I think I am summarizing this, the approaches that we may do in coaching. You may have seen this in that blog. A question that we often ask a client: What's the most successful experience you've had in the past that is most like this one? And that may be, what is the most successful extreme experience you've had in the past? What personal tools did you rely on or create to deal with that experience? Because that's what you're going to activate, is personal tools. They may be used in a different and unique way, but tools can be part of your identity, of how and who you see yourself to be. And perhaps even consider, what's the best practice you used to deal with that situation? So those are all really fundamental things. So this is basic to regulate states of mind and manage emotions to make a balanced decision, to reflect on core ideals or values and needs, to be loyal to those. That's so important, I believe, in working with a client. And often in working with a new client, I'll ask them to do, I'll send them an exercise to look at their top three needs and top three ideals or values. And both of us can be informed with that clarity to look at developing strategies and goals aligned with their identity and the tools that they use. Because any growth mindset is going to be based on their fundamental needs and ideals, their purpose in doing something. Then we can strategize to look at a systematic way of going about that. And that's where we do what you know very well about engaging in a coaching conversation with someone. So the things that just a basic self-regulation can prompt, to listen for the story that the source within you tells, and then to think about telling your story the way you want it in order to actualize it, plan it, map it, tell it, then initiate its creation. Whatever you're doing or whatever you're experiencing in any way is a response to the story that you're writing. Whatever you experience, you either create or you agree to. When you create it, the point of reference is inside you. If you agree to it and conform to what someone else may want, you've handed someone else the point of reference for your story. So as you align your story with your own identity, with who you really are, including your needs and ideals in focus, that helps you have a complete energy field and a full purposeful direction of that field going forward. This is creation of an authentic story. All of you goes in the same direction. And you're clear and purposeful about that. So that's why I think it's helpful to have an idea with a client about what their needs and their ideals are, not to assume that. And to know, and this is the growth mindset part, know that you can keep telling and living a better story no matter how good your story is. And the universe will resonate with and match your story as you live it. So let's look at one aspect of this that we may at times consider in coaching of pre-commitment. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men are sailing home from the Trojan War. You probably know this story. He's been warned about the sirens whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wants to hear it anyhow. So he does two things. He gives his men earplugs and gives them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore all subsequent pleas for release until they're safely past danger. This management of desire invents pre-commitment to inoculate himself against his predictable and potentially fatal future desire. He knows that willpower alone is not enough. And Odysseus knew that no one is immune to temptation, including himself. So pre-commitment can be especially useful when it comes to bad habits or obvious weaknesses, or simply planning to make a single good decision. An example of that, let's say you decide you want to save for retirement and make a major difference over time for a significant period of your time, whether or not you actually don't work. You decide, perhaps, then to make one good decision, to set up an automatic draw of $300 a month from your checking account to your retirement account, first of every month. It can make a huge difference over time. So this is a pre-commitment in a way. Now, to look at commitment devices, we help our kids do this. A piggy bank is a commitment device to counter impulsive decisions. Some alcoholics take Antabuse, a pill that makes you sick if you drink. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for three papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at that chance. Now, that always is the case. They could, any one of them at any time, could make a commitment to complete the paper by any date they decided before the end of the semester. But when it was structured, they became aware of it. People find ways of saving themselves from immediate cravings. A study at the Harvard Business School looked at the ways people dealt with purchasing want products they wanted versus products they feel they should have and needed. They would devise ways to put off purchasing or even having delivered the want products to ensure they do what they should do first. Now, here's a goofy example. Really goofy, but the application, I want you to listen for and not prejudge the goofiness of it. When my daughter left home for college, she wanted to leave something for me to remember her and our great times, as if she needed to. So she left my favorite food in all the world, Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries. And she did that the summer before she left, so I put it in the freezer because there's nothing like that first bite. And we would fight over who got the dark and the light. So I thought it would be a good idea. After she left, I would always keep a box of Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries. Well, they kept calling me. I could not, I've never been addicted to anything, but I would close to call that an addiction. So I decided, okay, I'm going to keep it at my ranch. Only a couple of days away. Well, they called for me there. And I'm just going to have two of them. I'm just going to have one. Didn't work. Nothing worked. There's a blog about this, by the way. So what I did was I didn't buy any chocolate-covered cherries ever again. And it's been 30 years, 20, well, it's been a long time since I've had one. Now, I worked with a guy. I knew him very well. I knew where he had a ranch and a compound where he had his corporate offices and had built all this. And one of our times in executive mentor coaching, he'd built a kind of an empire, and it was a real privilege to work with him. But he said, "Dave, you know, I've never talked with you about this before, but I've been to three programs to stop smoking. One of them, a very serious retreat program. Another, an inpatient program. I took it that seriously." He went to an inpatient program for 28 days on the West Coast. He said, "Nothing has kept me from smoking. I always go back to it. And I is there any way that you could help me?" I'm going to call him Art. Okay? I said, "Art, when you decide to smoke, what is a trigger or a cue?" He said, "Well, I just go to my desk." I said, "No, what do you experience the instant before, the frame, the second before you decide on a cigarette?" "Well, usually it's something kind of unsettling or tense, I guess." I said, "Then what do? "I go to my desk and get a cigarette." I said, "Where in your desk?" "Top left drawer." "Okay. How do they get there, Art?" He said, "Well, I buy them." I said, "Okay, here's what I would suggest when," and this was before I developed the neural conditioning chart and all the fancier self-regulation things, but I'm telling you the story for a purpose. I said, "When you're ready to stop," he said, "Oh, I'm ready. You just tell me what to do." And I violated everything I train you guys for by telling you what to do. I said, Art, when you're ready to stop smoking, you will not buy any more cigarettes or bring them in your office or anywhere in your compound, and you won't bum a cigarette off of any of your executives or any of your staff. And he thought, there was a long pause, like a minute. He said, okay. And I knew that would give him enough time to taper. And he was wise enough to taper because he had, I think he had a half pack left. And that was 7.5 years ago, and he hasn't had a single cigarette since. If it's not available, it's not possible to do it. And I knew that, you know, his compound was not anywhere close to a 7-Eleven, but it was part of his, even if there was one next door, it was still his commitment. So this is just one way of thinking about it. So let's look at engineering effectiveness. Now, a thought loop is when we mentally replay the same thought, review the same scenarios again and again. You can't find an exit. You keep thinking about the same thing. So think about a time when you had a negative thought loop, an argument with your spouse, a disappointing review, upsetting information about somebody in your family. Thought loops are being marooned in your left brain. There's some emotional trigger that boots instantly a time capsule, a state of mind that the content in that state has not changed, and it will not change. You can't therapize a change in that state. What you can do is to avoid that thought loop and to use the cue for it to get centered and grounded and look at what you do want to do, because that emotional trigger can be something that you can certainly manage. So here's a simpler way, even than for those of you who have looked at the Master States of Mind webinar that you can access free on the homepage of my website, MentorPath, the very bottom link, Master States of Mind. And there's a more systematic way to go about getting grounded and centered and doing neural conditioning with emotional triggers. And we've touched on that before. But here's a very simple way that I think you'll find a use for. Because think about the times you or a client has a recurring negative thought, negative self-talk, doubt, something that is a negative thought loop that just occurs seemingly random or in response to certain, but you can't get it out of your mind. So what's happened to create that is there was a time when that may have been protective. It may have been something that your brain sees as a way of engineering, a way of protection for you. So you have a negative thought loop. You don't even need to worry about where it comes from or what the trigger is. In this scenario, there are three R's. And write down these three R's to see if they'll be useful next time. You have self-doubt, a negative thought loop, something negative that you can't get out of your mind or that just comes and it seems to stop you in your tracks. Recognize that as an error message from your brain, because your brain's been hardwired to give you a warning to steer clear of something that you may have at one time perceived as danger. So recognize it as an error message from your brain's just doing its job description. It's been hardwired, and there's some trigger that boosts it up, but you don't even need, in this scenario, to figure out what it is or why it is, certainly not where it came from. That's not going to help you any at all. Recognize an error message from your brain in order to reframe. Let's say you have anxiety about what you're about to do, or a new venture, or something, a keynote to starting with a new client, reframe it instead of anxiety and danger, better head for cover, as recognizing the activation in your brain at that point to reframe it as challenge and opportunity. What are the possibilities here? So you recognize the error message from your brain, you reframe it, and you refocus on the next step in that framework. That's your little map. Recognize, reframe, refocus. And that puts you in a very focused position. And this is exactly what someone with attention challenges need to do, because this is a focused attention. We get what we focus on, not what we want. This is a powerful way to specifically focus on what's next. And then after that, what's next? So these are considerations in the map making that we do with clients. So focus specifically on the next step is the first of the essentials of engineering effective change. Here's an illustration of this. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed to average, though, 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was interviewed immediately after the race and asked, how did he keep going when he was exhausted and knew he had thousands of miles left? He responded simply, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. And he did that all the way across Canada. Now, he happened to know that the telephone poles ended at the end of the race. So he knew what he was doing. He had a map, but all he did was focus on the next telephone pole. Two, specify the next step. This is the how-to of choice architecture. Remember when we addressed that right at the beginning of this series? Specify the next step. Not abstract, not global. Some is not a number. Soon's not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. A specific step. Three, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are, where you're going, and be able to measure progress along the way and tell what detour and distraction is. One of those maps is the simple coaching model. Asking the client what they want to focus on, where they want to get to. You create a map with the client, determining that, signing on for it, and then you conclude with their summary and their commitment. Four, make progress measurable. A specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step each way. Make progress visible. Small, specific, attainable milestones that are visible, and with celebration of each small victory. And remember this, every time your client makes a step into the new and the different, there's going to be an almost paradoxical experience of uncertainty or trepidation, maybe even anxiety. And that can be reframed as a signpost of progress in new territory, and perhaps even more accurately perceived as excitement rather than anxiety. Remember, our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. It registers in exactly the same way. So how you frame it determines how you're going to proceed by choosing the mindset, the state of mind, to process it. Now, here's a best example of shrinking a task to a tangible next step. Alcoholics Anonymous. It's helped millions of people. Challenges its members to one day at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. And sometimes there's an emphasis on maybe the next hour, or even the next minute, whatever it takes. all you ever have to do is the next right thing. And I heard back in the day when I had a hospital practice as part of my psychiatry and psychoanalytic practice, one old codger who was a brilliant guy and a super guy who was an alcohol treatment counselor gave me permission to use this, because he would tell his patients, our patients, you know, sometimes you don't always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always damn well tell what it isn't. And that's so true. So here's looking at how we can enhance choices. These are considerations because they apply to emotions, which can set a framework for consideration. Increased tension can produce emotional regression, an indication to get grounded and centered. Increased emotion narrows perspective. It can create too narrow a framework to consider options in decision making. And then what this means is that when you're in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings. Sometimes the best first thing, especially when there's an emotional charge, is to do nothing, to get balanced, grounded, centered. When you're addicted to something, even action, the hardest thing to do is nothing. So getting grounded and centered creates more of a balanced decision, emotional and intellectual. And when you're really grounded and centered, you have the best access to all of your states of mind, all the information you possess. And this is something that I learned and learned to apply with professionals who had attention challenges, but it seems to be useful for everyone to lump tasks according to states of mind required to do them. It takes energy to change a state of mind, so clustering similar tasks that require the same state of mind is an effective strategy, because every time, let's say you're in your office, you're immersed in doing a task, you get a call, or you get a text, or there's a ping somewhere, or somebody does a curbside consult. You have to disengage from what you're focusing on, fully focus on the response to what you're doing, and then go back to what you're doing to get immersed again. So it's triple work. You know, it's been said that it takes as much energy to turn on a TV set as it does to have it operate for the next 5 hours. Now, I'm not sure about that, but there's a principle there about how much energy it takes to change states and how much clustering tasks that require the same state of mind can be very beneficial during the day. To not have interruptions of telephone, of internet, of text, until a designated time when you do all the things that cluster along that line. Now, I want to return to choice architecture, because there was a question about that from one of our initial groups of questions. Here's an example of choice architecture. A study at a local car wash ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Each time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card. And when they filled up the card with 8 stamps, they got a free wash. Now, another set of customers, same car wash, got a loyalty card in which they needed to collect 10 stamps rather than 8 to get a free car wash. But they were given a head start so that when they received their cards, 2 stamps had already been added. So, same situation. Took 8 stamps to get a free car wash. Goal was the same number of purchases, but the psychology and therefore the motivation, the framework was different. For those who got a head start, with it, as they saw it, with 2 stamps, they were 20% of the way toward a goal rather than starting from scratch. So when the results were in, 19% of the 8-stamp customers earned a free car wash, 34% of the Head Start group earned a car wash, and this group earned their free wash faster, meaning they were ready to start over and spend more money sooner. Now, this is important for how you listen to and collaborate with a client about the goals that they're pursuing and working on. People are motivated to be more finished with a longer task or journey than just beginning a shorter one. To motivate action, or facilitate that rather, would be to frame the task to help people know and recognize they're getting closer to the finish line. What this means is whenever you're working with a client and they take a step forward or make choices or see progress, is to highlight that progress, maybe by their experience. You know, I hear how excited you are about accomplishing that, or in some way resonating with and recognizing that progress because they already are feeling what they're feeling, which is their motivation for doing what they're doing. They're realizing their purpose. They're aligning with their identity, not just by the goal, but by the step-by-step process. And you're collaboratively engaging and resonating empathically with that experience. So that framework and that resonance, step-by-step, can make a huge difference because they're downloading the model that you and they are operating on all along the way. So here's another consideration. How you frame something can determine the meaning, and the meaning can change your mind. Your mind can change your brain, because meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or situation. So basically that means the structure of meaning is mostly an inside job. So here's an original experiment to illustrate this. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, and you've heard of these guys, and they are well known, but it's a simple illustration. They had subjects spin a wheel that would supposedly stop at random numbers between 1 and 100. Then they were asked, what percent of African countries belong to the United Nations? For one group of subjects, the wheel was preset to stop on 10. For the second group, it was preset to stop on 65. Well, the first group guessed that 25% of the nations belong to the United Nations. The second group guessed 45%. And the subjects insisted that the number on the wheel had no relation to the correct answer. So this is simply an illustration to determine how even irrelevant information can influence judgments, which can then influence decisions. So here's another simple example. One group of countries in Europe had an option that people can donate their organs unless they check a box that says they don't want to donate. They opt out. The rate of organ donation, 95%. Another group of countries have a form where if someone does donate their organs, they have to initiate that. They have to check the box to opt in. The rate of donation, 18%. That's the status quo bias. We tend to remain in the same place and doing the same things that we do, even when we sometimes know better. So a practical application here is we may help clients reframe. Somebody has a setback, a disappointment, or a crisis. So rather than continuing to focus on the problem, the upsetting issue, the negative energy, we can simply reframe, what's the opportunity here? Problem to possibility. Somebody runs out of a list of options or possibilities. what else? So this just simply determines what we focus on. What we focus on has a direct impact of where we can be effective. So this is a determination that we make moment by moment and day by day, how we can effectively determine how we frame and how we focus things. And this is an awareness that we can have about that. Here's an example that think about the applications for coaches and in coaching. Neuroscientists have found another brain paradox. This is information that I present as part of a keynote to 600 members of a consortium of nonprofit foundation. I saw a lot of raised eyebrows because this study was not known at that time. The paradox is that is inversely related to the pleasure center, the part of the brain that mediates social interactions, how we perceive and relate to others, the posterior superior temporal sulcus. This part of the brain, the altruism center, lights up when we help others and form bonds. This is part of the whole system that results in oxytocin, the connection. Here's the paradox. The pleasure center, dopamine, the spike with the anticipation, and the altruism center compete with one another. One or the other is in control, not both. When somebody does something like nonprofit charity work for altruistic reasons, the altruism center is firing. If money is offered, the altruism center shuts down and the pleasure center lights up. Here are a couple of examples. One large blood center, low on supplies for transfusion, decided to pay people to donate blood. Offering to pay promptly decreased the number of donors by half. What they found that reversed the effect? Letting the donors contribute the payment to charity. Another example, when daycare centers in Israel began fining parents for late pickups, the number of tardy parents doubled. What happened? The parents no longer felt ethically obligated to not inconvenience the teachers because they then felt they were paying the teachers for their lateness. Time became a commodity. Studies repeatedly show that a financial reward will undermine altruistic motivation. When the pleasure center hijacks the altruism center, motivation changes dramatically to that of self-interest. So here's a final illustration about roadblocks to success based on simply the way we see and frame things, the way our brains work. Darren Brown did an experience in the UK, in London on Regent Street, which has a lot of pedestrian traffic. Darren placed his wallet with money clearly sticking out on the sidewalk. Then he drew a circle with yellow chalk around the wallet, sort of like crime scenes on TV. Then he walked away, leaving the wallet lying there. Hundreds of people walked past the wallet. Most saw it. A number stopped to look at it, but not a single person would pick it up. The yellow chalk circle seemed to be a barrier that people were reluctant to cross. Now, he did another match study in another part, another day, where there was no, and most people picked up the wallet. The yellow chalk circle created a barrier, an assumption that limited people from simply picking up the wallet. Here's the question from this. Do you have a yellow chalk circle? And a hint here, it's any assumption that limits you. So, here's a practical summary of listening. As mentor coaches, we become accustomed to listening to a story without trying to fix it. First, put your ego in a blind trust. In other words, don't take it personally. Listen to the language, active or passive. Listen to the point of reference, whether internal or external. This is all about listening from the vantage point, the metaphor of a story. Listen to the source of authority, whether it's self or others. Listen for the initiation of action, whether it's proactive or reactive. Listen for how centered the speaker is in his or her experience. Listen for the state of mind of the speaker. This should probably be first. And whether the state of mind is regulated and fits the task. So here's a summary of successful mentor coaching of changes with the mind and brain in mind. We focus on solutions rather than understanding why, on co-creating options rather than advice or dictates. Since old patterns are hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to change this wiring. The first requirement is claiming ownership of the story by the client, followed by the recognition in order to understand, assess, and change that it has to be the client's story. They're writing their own story. Peter Drucker said, the most pressing task is often how to teach people how to learn. So let's review some important elements required to do mentor coaching with the mind and brain in mind. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Simply identifying a problem is a step toward the wrong pathway, because identifying a problem won't solve it. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize to lay new mental maps or to initiate new pathways in the brain. Regulate your state of mind to manage emotions to promote full access to all the information, all the experiences of mind and brain, emotional and intellectual. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left and right brain, intellectual and emotional. That's, you know, a too simplistic way of saying it, but you know what I'm talking about here. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. People can usually discriminate between inquiries that prompt insight or attempts at persuasion. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance or problems. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, to facilitate a new level of mastery. If the client diverts to an old feeling or behavior or problem, redirect ideas and energy flow to the new idea. What's the challenge here? What's the opportunity here? Remember that power is in the focus and that permanent change arises from consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and the brain. Conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process. Help them create their own map, to recognize it's their story. It's not there until they create it. This can help them access and outline a way to process new experiences as part of a storyline and an evolving identity. So here just is a kind of a closure. Here are a couple of my predictions, since you asked. Going forward, and this is where we can have a major role as mentor coaches, we're in a pioneer profession, and we have access to so many bodies of knowledge and sciences and even arts that we can apply. Going forward, we will develop ways of recognizing and understanding synchronicities, and these are predictions, individual and collective energy fields, and a number of phenomena which are part of our experience and universe that in the tomorrows ahead we will evolve concepts and descriptive systems. I believe we'll develop words and a language, a nomenclature for things we can only sense right now. For example, individual and collective energy fields. This stems from Einstein's unified field theory of human energy. The magician Harry Houdini reminded us, just because something's unexplained doesn't mean it's supernatural. So, to paraphrase Garrison Keillor, be well, be happy, and go out and do good works. It's been my pleasure and my privilege to discuss these notions with you in these four seminars. I hope we'll have additional opportunity to collaborate. Thank you. You don't have to wait for me to get off lecture mode now to add or ask or discuss or highlight anything or even a sentence of what the most important thing you're taking away. Simply go off mute, star six, and say, I'm very interested in your input and your thoughts right now. And particularly if I've answered the questions that a number of you have sent in, which I deeply appreciate. Thoughts, questions?
Hey, David, this is Tracy here.
Okay, would you do a little bit louder or a little closer to your microphone, please?
Sure. This is Tracy. I was wondering, can you hear me a little bit?
Hey, welcome. Go ahead. Thanks.
Yes. This has just been a phenomenal program. It's been a wealth of information, especially the reference to going to your website to see the webinars that in the blogs that you had there, because they were just a great add-on to the program. Like, it's been helpful for myself. I've been I'm taking the other program too, but it's probably why it's all like fitting like a glove. It did feel very contentious at first, because it was like, how do I do this? I was a little scared. There was definitely a lot of trepidation. But going through the steps and learning that the process and how to set things up, and I'm just feeling more confident, I'm feeling more able, and learning of the information has definitely made me view it differently. So it's almost like I'm going through it so I can it feels like I can understand the process that my clients are probably going to go through. Not exactly the same, but at least I can have an empathetic view of how this process will work with them. So, thank you.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And remember a couple of things. It likely will be most helpful after you listen to something, whether it's one of these seminars, a podcast, or anything, if you write down the most important thing that you're taking away from that, because that makes it yours then. And remember the University of Waterloo study that I've repeatedly referenced, that two matched groups of people read the same passage in a book, they all took a test, half of them who read it out loud did 40% better than the half who read it silently. They put it in an output channel, and in our brains that completes the circuitry and makes it more of a memory.
Thank you. Thank you. Just, I appreciate that. Thank you.